Okay, starting now, if you could be quiet. So I was exploring the idea that there are three general kinds of data that psychology uses and would prefer to explain, and that we'd probably prefer it, if we can, to have theories that manage to address all three kinds of data rather than just one or two. What I asked you to, provided you could find the right web page, find was these discussion questions. So anyone care to volunteer an answer for the first one? What issues do you think most people would expect psychology to answer? Yep. Happiness for everyone.
I think that's the ultimate goal of science. Happiness.
No, I agree. I think that's a good everyday question.
So why are some people evil?
Why are some people evil?
That's what some people think.
That's the second one. Any others? You want to explain human behaviour? You're just not an open person who's happy for other people to do what they like. No, that's quite right. Everybody should behave just as we predict. No surprises anymore? So the second half of the question, if you like, for those three everyday things was, do you think psychology has answered any of them? So did you have a... So psychology is a dreadful failure against that everyday thing. Well, no, I think that's entirely fair, in fact. So what was the second one? Evil. What does anyone think about whether psychology has answered anything about evil? You're evil and you can say you've been completely explained? No. Sorry, people probably do have answers to...
People who have many questions. People have many questions. We don't have answers. So probably people expect technology to answer their questions.
Their questions.
They don't understand themselves or walk outside us.
Right. But that's really asking whether you think psychology research has started to provide an answer to the question of evil. That's probably not entirely true. So I think that psychologists who think that abusing children early in life is likely to lead to many undesirable outcomes, some of which would be criminal. I think social psychologists would probably say that if you put average people in a certain situation, they'll commit acts that you would say are evil, but which they wouldn't commit in others. So that would be about immediate, say, mob behaviour. So there are a few fragments around, I think.
The second thing that brings some answers to your research, the thing is that every answer that we find kind of opens up more questions, which have yet to be answered again.
Oh, no, that's true. Still, that question was about, do we think that psychology has begun to answer them, rather than has it answered all questions in an ever-increasing reservoir?
More information in the question, you can do
No, I think that's very important, that researchers, perhaps the most common thing for research to do is to edit the question and give reasons why the way it was originally posed isn't an illuminating way to ask it. Yes, no, I think that's right. The point that was made just a few seconds ago about the more research, the more questions. I still haven't moved on from what a school teacher told me when I was about 10, I think. He drew his diagram on the board. He said, you know, you boys know very little. That's like a little dot here. But you'll notice that as the circle of what you know grows, the circumference grows, that is, the borderline with the unknown, the new questions, expands in line and in proportion to knowledge. And I suppose I still feel that. And going back to happiness and positive psychology, that's certainly a new field in psychology, but there are some positive results. Of course, it's unclear whether that's a general answer, because those results are usually about showing you can increase someone's happiness in particular cases, in particular situations, and those situations very often are about getting volunteer subjects. What we know much less about is if you try and forcibly impose practices that ought to make you happy, whether that will ever work. Okay, so that was getting you... getting you thinking. It's a new volume control, you see. It's either high or it's low. Right. Guarded by the impressive audio bulk of my belly. Right. Okay, so those were questions from last time. I'm now going to continue on the theme of types of evidence. So, is my voice still coming out the speakers? Yes? It's just not booming? Good. So, related to this idea of different kinds of evidence is that they can give different answers, and one most important reason for them giving different answers is when there's actually an inconsistency inside the mind of the participant. So, and it's certainly true. Is that my money? Bloody poor pay, but I'll take it anyway, yes. There's certainly a slight tendency in psychology to do experiments which show people being irrational or contradicting themselves, which is a bit unfortunate because that sort of can make psychology research look as if it's sneering at inferior people. I think the positive aspect of that, though, is to be aware that, in general, although we do a surprisingly good job of appearing to be rational, that is, if you challenge me about why I'm doing something, I can usually give reasonable reasons for that. Nevertheless, actually, we have imperfectly coherent partial knowledge in our head, and therefore there are times when we can catch ourselves out or other people can catch us out in some sort of contradiction. And those are, of course, revealing, potentially good things. So, saying the same thing in other language. So just to take a very particular micro example, past literature on children's conceptions of physics can frequently produce cases where different aspects of their knowledge contradict each other. So a classic demonstration that stays in my mind is suppose say I'm teaching a class of children, I have a model of a helter-skelter, that is, a tower where the child, if it was full scale, the child could climb to the top and slide down a spiral slide. Or in the model, I'd probably be releasing a small ball to go down the spiral. And the question for the child is, if you release a ball at the top of the slide so it goes down like that, in which direction will it travel when it leaves the bottom of the slide? And there are different ways of asking it. You can ask them to predict the direction, to have a think and then point in the direction they think it will go. Or you can say, catch the ball when I drop it. And where they move their hands will show in a behavioral way where they kind of instinctively think it will go. Or you can show them where it goes and then ask them to explain why it went in that way. And it's fairly easy to find children, and perhaps more embarrassingly undergraduates, who will actually effectively make different answers depending on whether you tap into their behavior, you tap into their ability to generate explanations, or you tap into their ability to predict. And that's just an indication that all of us are full of bits of partial knowledge. It's amazing we sound as rational as we do. Not too surprising that there are some deviations. But that's relevant, of course, in psychology, because just because two sources of data conflict doesn't mean there's something necessarily wrong with your measurements. It can be revealing of mental processes as well. The second bullet point there, slips and mistakes. There's an area of psychology which I think you won't get taught here about human error. There have been William James, more than 100 years ago, but also people much more recently, particularly Jim Reason, have done quite a lot of studies of human error and tried to categorize them. One which I hope will make some sense to most of you straight away is that when I'm typing on a keyboard into a computer, I'm usually not looking at my fingers, I'm usually looking at the screen. And an interesting thing is I often know I've made a typo before I've seen it on the screen. And when you think about that, that's a bit odd. I mean, how can I know I've done it wrong? Why didn't I do it right in the first place? It's as if, and this must be the case, that my brain dispatches messages to the fingers, and what comes back from my fingers can tell me whether or not they did it right. Those are usually called slips, but that's one kind of dislocation. Mistakes are a different kind of dislocation where the person carries out an action and at the time they're completely confident it's the right action, but when you make them stop and think about it, sometimes they realize just what it was, that they did it wrong. In other words, they had within their mind the ability, if they thought hard enough, to work out what the right action was, which wasn't the one they did, and yet can execute confidently the wrong one at times. I've now forgotten what the theorists say in that area, but an example of so-called capture errors, for instance, which probably all of us have done a few of, but it will be different ones for different people. Capture error is where you've got a well-ingrained habit, and sometimes a habit takes over when, if you've been paying more attention, it did the wrong thing. So when I was a postdoc and people in the lab working on this, an example one of the students produced was, this was in America, he came in from the gym where he'd been playing basketball, took off his sweaty t-shirt in the bathroom, and threw it not in the laundry basket but into the toilet bowl. And of course, both of those are receptacles. They're both about the same size. They both certainly will take the shirt, but it's actually not the one he meant, really, when he stopped to think about it. So in considering the fact that we probably, on the whole, prefer to use several sources of data, we have to consider what contradictions mean, and that can actually be revealing itself rather than just some data is better than another. Now, I'm going to elaborate slightly on the point. So type B data is about internal experience, what you feel inside. Now, to make this point, I have to say that, first of all, in all academic areas, there's an important educational issue that's usually not handled very well in formal education in university, and that is that there are two perspectives to this. So, in English literature, the two perspectives might be how I feel when I attend a performance of a great play versus how I write a critical academic essay about it. In physics, it's about learning Newton's equations and doing calculations in school versus whether or not you actually connect those abstract ideas to pushing a supermarket trolley. Because if you do pay attention to your situation, supermarket trolley in a nice, flat, smooth supermarket floor, you can actually feel that you need a harder push to actually accelerate it and almost no push at all to keep going, just as Newton said. Most people, of course, sit in lectures, learn to do these abstract exams, don't connect it to personal experience. But really, it's a much fuller understanding if you do make those connections. And this applies in every area. So I gave a couple of examples, but if you think about it a bit more, every area really has both a private experiential one aspect and a public abstract shared one, which is directly communicated in textbooks. Now, psychology, I think, has a unique additional issue in that there are two kinds of experiential aspect which ideally we would bring to make connections with every time we learn a new theory in some area of psychology. So, and those two are, how does it feel like when it happens to me? And the other is, how does it look when I see this happening to someone else? So, if you're talking about, let's say, clinical depression, there's one issue about what it looks like when you meet a patient who's got clinical depression, and it's another about how do those symptoms feel when they're gripping you. Or to take a simpler area in human emotion, all of us, when you think about it, have actually got two jobs with respect to emotion. One is learning to recognize emotions in yourself, and the other is learning to recognize them in other people, since that's generally very important in family life and, in fact, in life in general. And those are two different things, and we can certainly imagine people who've got one and not the other, but more likely is we just learn those a bit differently. So I've got it on a slide somewhere else. But there's a classic joke I always find funny and recognizable that sort of illustrates this, where let's say my sister says to me, "You're getting angry," and I immediately say, "No, I'm not," thus sort of demonstrating a failure in me to recognize my anger and her correct perception. And that can happen without me intending to make a joke or being abnormally obtuse. It's just pointing out that how an emotion feels from the inside is different from how it looks to someone else interacting with it. Sorry. Which is different again from what a theory of emotion we might try and say in explanation. So what it looks like in someone else, it's my personal experience of learning to recognize that, because of course any doctor, just like any engineer, a large part of their learning, one often not particularly well supported academically, is what does this look like in concrete cases? What we might call the second person perspective, where you're a personal witness but you're not experiencing it, and the first person experience is what it feels like from the inside. Now, this is very important in psychology, it's important in practical medicine, but it's on the whole not an issue in most disciplines. However, I want to comment on this personal and private and experiential versus the public abstract ones in another way. My PhD was in visual perception, and Adalbert Ames is a particular kind of hero in that field. He was an artist originally and published in psychology later. Where you'll have come across his work, although, is very many science museums or exploratories nowadays have an Ames room. That is one of those rooms that when you look in through just the right window, you see an apparently rectangular room, and let's say two people in it, one of whom looks like a revolting giant and the other like a midget, and actually when they swap positions, you realize they're both about the same height, but somehow the room was changing your perception. Now, that's a very successful demonstration that works on essentially everybody. And Adelbert Ames, in fact, designed something like 50 of them, but the room is by far the most famous and common one. Now, what Adelbert Ames thought, contrary to all other academic psychologists, was that you hadn't really done a decent job if you merely got data from some small sample, and probably a third of those didn't show the effect. What you needed to do was to create the conditions where everyone could experience it. So if you're dealing with visual illusions, you have to create an illusion so successful everyone experiences it. And then, of course, no one will ask you to do stats or anything. They'll believe from their own experience. Now, this is so not like what most academic psychology is, but I think it's, again, in a course like this, it's worth realizing there are other kinds of standards for proof based on other things. And certainly, my own research area these days is in learning and teaching in higher education, what makes for good learning and so on. And when I'm considering how to design an experiment to show that, let's say, one kind of note-taking in students is actually better for their learning than another, the detached point of view is I somehow persuade them to sit in the experimental or control group that I want, and I look for a difference in the means between groups. On the other hand, a slightly different experimental design can make this much more useful to the students themselves. So if I arrange for it to be a within subjects experiment so that each student experiences both kind of note-taking, then besides how the means differ, every participant will know from their personal experience in the experiment which of the two methods was better for them. And that would be much more in the spirit of Adelbert Ames. I should also say that this isn't just about psychology. Some of today's most glamorous bits of science are in the tradition of producing instruments where essentially everyone can see. So let's take microscopes, for instance. The invention of the microscope allowed humans to see for the very first time that they were actually microscopic, in the very literal sense, little animals swimming around in an average drop of water in a pond. And no one had been able to see those before because our eyes aren't good enough for things that small. But with a microscope, everybody can see them. So although that's science, it's also, in these cases, done by instruments that essentially work for everyone. And that's very different from reading a report about how if you have done 5 years training in advanced stats and clever physics, you can deduce from this cloud of particle trails that something happened. That's not something that the public can ever believe except at third hand. It's different when Galileo produces a telescope where everyone can see the moons of Jupiter, and if they watch Two Nights Running, they can see that they've moved. And it doesn't rely on someone else's expertise. It's, you can experience it directly yourself. So telescopes and microscopes are like that, and engineering is to the extent that you may not feel you understand why aeroplanes, which are so huge and made of metal and ought to fall out the sky, why they fly, but you can see it. And when you've seen that enough people haven't died, then you can try it yourself. And you don't understand the theory, but you certainly believe that planes can fly. So perhaps I should elaborate the idea that there are three broad kinds of data and suggest that some of those happen twice. So if we think about behavior in psychology, we should strictly perhaps think about not only what other people's behavior looks like, but what my behavior looks and feels like from the inside. Certainly, there are some things you won't do well unless you can do that, like being a physiotherapist, for instance, or You might think being a physiotherapist has nothing to do with psychology. One of the very best students I've ever known in this department, though, graduated a couple of years ago, and wasn't interested, at least at first, in going off to do a PhD. She thought it would be better for her personal development if she took care of her demented aunt for a year. And after that, she decided she'd train to be a physiotherapist, where you're meeting patients, you're touching them, you're having a very personal relationship that's to do with their physical as well as their mental well-being. I have a lot of respect for her. I just sit in an armchair and read stuff, and I don't actually think in that holistic way that Cleo does. So A, perhaps we should split behavioral data into two kinds, how it looks like from the outside, how it feels like from the inside. And as regards thinking and feeling, there are two kinds of that. One is how I experience myself from the inside, but also how I experience other people through my perceptions. So there's the "you're getting angry" revealing joke. Okay. The rest of the next section in this lecture is about what I call for short the Newtonian triad. Right. So first of all, this section of the lecture is dealing with the same area as this piece of the textbook does, although I'm putting it in a very different way. And if you manage to connect the two, you're doing well. Several of you have asked me about textbooks. The library has plenty of copies, including, I believe, an electronic version, which you could probably all of you access, of this textbook. So you may like to inspect before you buy, or use the library instead of buying. That's up to you. One of the pages hanging off my main webpage for this course has not only got the textbooks, but I've got direct links to the bits of the library for your convenience. And I also list the Schultz book and one other. Right, so Isaac Newton, hero of mine, but no reason why he should be a hero of yours. So the question here is, are some of the basic ideas in philosophy of science, which were really, although they always talk about it as philosophy of science, most of it's philosophy of physics, and the question is, to what extent, if any, does it really apply in psychology? Now, first of all, there's, I think it's worth pointing out, there's a prior issue, really, about whether we should expect science to work. Why, and even if it worked in one area, why should we expect it to work in every area? And one of the interesting things about Isaac Newton was he wrote quite a lot on physics, but he wrote even more on theology. He was a sincere and heretical Christian, and it's taken me many years to think about this. But I think, essentially, you see, what is the impulse of Newton's brand of religion about trying to work out a particular theology? It too assumes that there is something to discover, that there is a hidden pattern that it's very important to uncover. And and of course there's no prior reason why that should be, but of course if you assume there isn't, you'll never look, so you'll never find out. So it's obviously useful for anyone who comes after, that you were gripped by this irrational belief and there was something to discover. In physics, I should say, this becomes a little more naked in modern physics, where physicists often say they're looking for a theory of everything, by which they mean that, depending slightly on how they count, they would have said 50 years ago that there were four fundamental, really fundamental forces they'd discovered. There was electromagnetism, gravity, the so-called weak nuclear force, and a strong nuclear force. And their idea of a theory of everything is finding a single theory which actually explains all four together and makes them consistent. And it's that same impulse about not just is there anything to discover, but is there in fact just one underlying thing that if we discovered that would lead to everything else? And Newton was certainly quietly gripped by that, and his descendants today in modern physics are pretty gripped by that too. Right, now, what do I mean by the Newtonian triad? Well, I'm attributing to Isaac Newton, I think correctly, but those of you who know more history may eventually be able to catch me out a bit, is that the kind of successful theories he developed in several areas of physics really had these features. There was a theory, that is, a general abstract statement. There was also a calculation method that let a person go from that theory to specific predictions in particular cases. And thirdly, there was using empirical observation as a check. So all three elements. And one of the reasons why calculation and prediction is felt to be important in science is because, well, let me put this crudely in a way you probably won't see in a book. More and more I think that the feeling of understanding something is essentially an emotion. It's the emotion that I think everybody values quite a lot. It's probably the one that I'm most dedicated to in my life. But I'm calling it emotion because having that feeling does not correlate well with actually really understanding something. You can understand it pretty well and yet not feel that very strongly, or you can be completely gripped by a eureka feeling and later it turns out you weren't really right. So whether someone feels they understand something, although it's a clue, it's certainly not reliable. And there was a neat psychology experiment I learned a bit about, Kirsten Beauvais, where they actually in a sense demonstrated this, because they had a fictitious theory that participants in some of the conditions had to learn about how the Starship Enterprise's phaser weapons worked, and they had a control board and a certain problem solving actions they had to take, and they could demonstrate that you could have theories which really did help practical action, or you could have theories which gave a feeling of understanding but turned out not to have any real consequences for making it work, and they were both equally satisfying to participants. And so I say that's a neat psychology demonstration of what I'm asserting about how the feeling of understanding is not reliable. And that's one way of saying why it's important to have not a theory, not a general statement. So, for instance, in the 18th century, there was a popular, though not particularly mainstream, theory in Britain anyway, probably, I think, in the whole of Western Europe, that that because God was omniscient, omnipotent, and basically benevolent, therefore, everything that happened must be the best that could possibly happen. Now, that's a great example of there isn't any possible evidence that would ever disprove that. So, I mean, it's a bit like a naive astrologer saying that whatever happens, the stars did predict it. It was just you didn't understand the signs correctly. So you can state theories that are so generally they imply everything, and if they imply everything, they have no real value. So part of the idea of the triad really is you need a theory to make calculations about situations you've never seen. You need a way of making those calculations to bridge between the general theory and concrete cases, and you need to have real empirical observations in order to discover if there's something wrong with your theory. Those are the three. Now, given those three, there are still different ways of proceeding. So what I call recipe one there has been really very unfashionable for some time now, which doesn't mean it doesn't go on, it just means you can't boast about it. Induction is really where you collect a bunch of cases and then invent a generalization which seems to cover all those cases, and what you hope is it'll also cover cases you haven't seen yet. And indeed, although this is not said these days very much, I think that's essentially how science proceeds. Where do theories come from? I mean, in psychology, where it's definitely not done to do induction out loud, you hear about a theory for the first time in a paper which has got a little experiment which seems consistent with it. You don't hear where the theory comes from very often. Now, the trouble and why induction's out of fashion is because of a serious logical problem, and Karl Popper is credited with expressing most clearly why induction is not a good account of science, and that is, you can never prove a theory to be true because just because you've seen a million cases of swans and all swans were white, to use a classical and outdated example, that doesn't mean tomorrow you won't see a black swan. And indeed, when Europeans got to Australia, they saw black swans. So, and that is just an example that illustrates the vulnerability of induction to utter disproof tomorrow at any time. Why I think it's important to draw this to your attention, though, is because just saying you can't trust it doesn't mean we don't probably do it and probably have to do it. And in fact, I'd be more aggressive than that. I'd point out that some of the rather famous sciences operating today, induction is still active. That is, they're still discovering things they've never seen before. They're not hypothesis testing, they're actually learning surprises from observation. So in zoology, still new species being discovered. There's absolutely no pretense that Darwin can predict what species will exist, or at least that we're able to use Darwin to predict what species exist. It's about zoologists in the field, or botanists, discovering cases. And this is even more true in astronomy, where of course they have to write grant applications for these unthinkably expensive things like space telescopes, and they'll say why they want to build a telescope and what existing theories they hope to test. But they're also much more upfront that every time they build a bigger telescope, they discover something that was utterly not expected at all, and the surprises are usually more important than the hypothesis testing about old hypotheses. So if you believe too much about the crude story that science is hypothesis testing, you actually end up saying big science like astronomy and old science like zoology is not science, and that actually doesn't make much sense. Still, Popper's argument is about falsifiability. So Popper wanted to disallow theories which weren't testable, and this puts weight on what I'm calling the second leg of the Newtonian triad, that is making predictions, and then the third leg of actually observing whether they're right or not. Right, I'm going to make a few points about experiments because you'll be getting such a lot of emphasis on experiments in psychology. A little while ago, there was a very interesting TV documentary I saw by this chap, Armand Leroy, about Aristotle's biology, where he said he came across, Leroy is a prominent biologist himself, and when he read through Aristotle's biology, written 2,500 years ago roughly, certainly more than 2,000, he was astonished at how modern it was in many ways. It described the creatures within Aristotle's observation on the island of Lesbos, and Aristotle had dissected many of them, gathered many fishermen's reports. He'd organized, most surprising really, is he organized it not as an amateur like me probably would, species by species, but he organized the book organ system by organ system, that is comparing livers in fish with livers in lizards and so on like that, very much like a modern zoological text. So it was very impressive, but his punchline at the end was the one thing that meant was different between Aristotle and what we'd call science is that Aristotle never did an experiment in the sense of producing a prediction and testing it. And he gave an example of a famous experiment which Aristotle could easily have done technically. So up to 150 years ago, many people thought that life, lower forms of life, could spontaneously generate out of nothing. That is, wouldn't have parents, they just spontaneously generate. And the most common everyday observation of that is you leave a little lump of meat out in the hot sun, and a few days later, maggots hatch out in it. And casual observation, you won't know where they came from. But if you put a bit of muslin over it, which is just a thick enough cloth to stop a fly being able to insert its eggs through it, then the bit with the muslin on won't have maggots, although it'll still probably stink. So Aristotle is like, on this account, is like the peak of an armchair scientist. That is, he works in the library, he might work a little bit on practical stuff. He's extremely clever and sees how to organize a chaotic field of observations into a systematic presentation, but he didn't in the end test whether his structure was right. Didn't even consider it, really. So in considering the general category of observational data, you might think about maybe four stages of development. One is collection and memory. The second is you go out of your way to collect things that are likely to be odd. So that's when the train spotter doesn't just list trains at his local station, but goes to particular peculiar places. Learning by exploration is when you start fiddling with them. But the modern development of experiments, which does add something special, is full-on experiments to isolate causal factors. So there are really two things, I think, which an experiment does. One is to isolate one factor from all others, and the other is to establish the causal direction, not just that one factor is associated with a change in measurements, but that it causes it in the sense that changing the factor will change the measurements, not the other way around. Now, there are actually two different reasons for getting at causation, which is probably important for you to distinguish One is about what's going on in the natural world without you interfering, because by separating out causal factors, you can illuminate what goes on. A separate reason is if you are an applied scientist, at least for the moment, and psychology, of course, all clinical applications are applied, same in education. And then an applied scientist actually wants to change the world, and they want to know about causation so they can move the levers themselves, not just in order to establish how what causes are going on under the surface of naturally occurring situations. On the other hand, is causation really the be-all and end-all? Almost exactly 100 years ago now, Bertrand Russell mentions in a throwaway paragraph in something he wrote how, in spite of the fact that a lot of lay people think science is all about causation, actually the most advanced science, by which of course he meant the most advanced physics, often the theories describe relationships. They don't tell you about causation. So you've probably all heard of the conservation of momentum. That's a way of calculating that the momentum must add up afterwards. It doesn't say anything about how it gets transferred. It doesn't say in which direction it'll get transferred. It's just that it must be conserved. So a lot of advanced physics is expressed as equations, and equations are about equalities, they're about balances. They're not actually talking about direction. And you can turn that the other way around too. If you think about the way Newton led to the ability to predict where a planet would be in the future, that's prediction in the normal sense. But equally, absolutely equally, it predicts where planets were in the past from the same data. And that isn't prediction about what you can do in the future. That's relating a past position to the present. So it's not really true that science is inherently about causation, although all applied science is absolutely about causation and getting control of it. So, in developing a critical appreciation of the role of experiment, it's important to remember that there are very important parts of science which don't rely on experiment, really, don't even do it, perhaps. And furthermore, that causation is what applied people like engineers need to know, but it isn't necessarily directly important in theoretical science. So, to draw to a close, here's a critical thinking tip. One way, among many ways, of looking at how much you approve of a given reported experiment could be in terms of how far in this little developmental progression you go. So one thing is to note that there could be more than one reasonable opinion or theory about an effect. A second is to arrive at a judgment, not sit on the fence, but try and decide on the balance of evidence which is the best explanation, even though you can't be sure it's right, you think one's better. But maybe the really advanced thought would be not to be writing a report and leave it to someone else to act on it, but to propose an experiment to actually resolve the issue which you've decided isn't yet fully understood. So, here are three questions for the next time. They're up on my webpage. I'd like you to have a think about that, discuss it with a friend, and I'll see you tomorrow. Mm-hmm.